Hello, this is Catherine Bradford. Thank you very much for joining me today. Imagine in the near future that we have the first female pope. Imagine she's a native of Nigeria and comes to the attention of the Vatican by her healing powers. From the humble beginnings as a nun to creating the most powerful shift in the Catholic Church in 2,000 years, Pope Annalisa shows us that the world will never be the same. In this incredible award-winning novel, Peter Canova takes us into a journey of the near future in a way that is powerful and suspenseful. Pope Annalisa is the first book in the First Souls trilogy, a trilogy that concerns the first fall of spirit into material existence as told through the lives of characters whose incarnations appear over different epochs of history. To say Peter Canova is a gifted, inspired, and visionary author is an understatement. Pope Annalisa is destined to be well recognized, well respected, and in itself a revelation of what may lie ahead. Please join me in welcoming Peter Canova. Hi, Peter. How are you?
Good. Good to talk with you.
Thank you so much for joining me. I'm very, very happy to have you with me today. And I just have to tell you immediately that I have not been so shook up by a book in such a long time. It's just a really wonderful thing that you've done in writing this book, and I think your acknowledgement that the world's giving you for it is well-deserved, and you must be just thrilled.
Well, thank you. It's kind of funny because I feel a little bit of, I guess, a little sense of detachment about the issue and the awards. I kind of feel it's more the book winning the awards than me, and although I know that sounds funny because I wrote the book, I did and I didn't. Sometimes I feel this information kind of flows through, and although, yes, I do craft it with my words and things like that, I somehow feel that these ideas or these higher, I guess, some of these inspirations, they don't really belong to me sometimes.
Well, you know, it's really interesting that you start off saying that. It's no surprise to me because one of my very first questions I wanted to ask, and I thought, I wonder if Peter will find this an odd question, but I was going to say, well, who are you really? You know, because I really get that. I mean, by reading the book, it connected me as well to something that was so much larger than either you and I could even begin to describe. And it felt so obvious to me that you had been gifted with, you know, the power of having this knowledge or these feelings or this, just the inspiration come into you that you had the wherewithal to sit down and write the book in the first place. It's such a wonderful, what could I say? You know, an honor that you've been given, don't you think?
Well, the book still obviously has a long way to go in terms of spreading into the general population, and I think that I kind of take a humble approach to that. I mean, the awards are a good beginning, and being on shows like yours and being able to reach out to people and let them know what the book is about is a beginning, but it's still got a very long way to go. I think that the creation of the book was a confluence of circumstances. Partly it was from my own channel meditations and things that I would pick up in my meditations. Partly it was from 25, 30 years of research and really what I would call practical spirituality. It was a sort of spiritual practice that, and being a Capricorn, mm-hmm. and I guess being pragmatic, I don't sort of think too much about a lot of the spirituality that's propagated in New Age circles these days, which mm-hmm. doesn't really have very much of a basis or practical application in order to help people and change their lives.
Mm-hmm.
And I've always been more oriented towards actually having direct experiences rather than repeating, let's say, where I feel some of the shortcomings of mainstream religion are, which is essentially spouting off some dogmas that people take second and third hand and don't really experience the true spiritual feeling behind them. I think a lot of that also happens in metaphysical and New Age, what they call New Age circles today. In fact, New Age has become a little bit of a pejorative term just
right.
because of that.
Right.
And I always, what I really wanted in this book was not only to relate the direct experiences I had with higher consciousness that allowed me to funnel through some of this information and put it together in the form of this book, but to point a way that other people could begin in past to have the same experience themselves. So the book itself, I mean, one of the reasons I think people like the book is that it's a profoundly spiritual work, but it's not a type of spirituality that beats you over the head and tries to say, okay, well, you know, I've got a new ism for you to follow. There are no isms in here for you to follow.
Absolutely.
What it really is like a signpost. It's like a beacon light out there in the road that we're walking, and it says, you know, here's a direction that may really help you if you want to pursue this path. And I've been down that path myself, and I dearly hope that when other people read this book, it will sort of help them along the same way.
You know, it's interesting. My own personal experience over the many, many years of being on the air and interviewing people like yourself that have come with their great gifts and their wisdom and their articulate ability to, you know, put it in the written word, and lots of different varying topics. But nonetheless, one of the many things that struck me in reading the book was the fact that so much of the individual efforts that I've had the pleasure of being connected to over the past many years were all sort of threaded through the book and interwoven. So the pieces fit together. It made me sort of laugh because I kept thinking of the phrase, all roads lead to Rome, and there you are, you know, with the book being what it is. But it's really interesting that I think we sit in a time unlike any other where even though the book is fictionalized, it's so laced, interlaced with truth and truth in history and truth in concept and truth in perceptions that it's sort of a staggering piece in that regard.
Well, I think this might be a good time to talk a little bit about what the book is about for the sake of the listeners.
Right.
Haven't had a chance to pick it up and look at it yet. But
right.
I always think of the book as really two stories, one of which is a thriller set in the near future. It's about a miracle-working African nun who becomes, she gains a lot of notoriety and comes under suspicion of the church for miracles she's performing in the country of Nigeria. And she's also upsetting the Muslim fundamentalists down there because some Muslims are converting because of what they see of, you know, her spiritual force and her healings. And so she's really kind of making enemies on both sides. And the world that they're in is a rather bleak world in the near future, where resources of oil and water are scarce, and Iran has gone nuclear and coming to a very dangerous confrontation with America. And the friction between the great powers is boiling over, largely related to the scarcity of resources. So the book has a very realistic and timely aspect to it, in that it mm-hmm. speaks to many issues mm-hmm. that we are facing today, just kind of extrapolating them out into the near future. But the difference here is that it's taking the way that the book addresses those problems is not typically through political, socioeconomic, or military means, but it's rather a spiritual solution in the book, which is rather startling by the end of the book.
Right.
And so that part of it, the spiritual part of it, is really what I call the backstory, the underpinning of the book, because we follow the lives of the main characters, and they're racing against the Holocaust to understand what this woman, Annalisa, is about. Throughout much of the book, we don't know whether she is a force for good or a force for evil, whether she's the bringer or the creator or the destroyer of this harsh new world, whether she's going to be the savior or she's the one who really is sort of the source of the problem here.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that that's related to the fact that I was thinking about that when Jesus was teaching in Palestine and performing his miracles.
Right.
How many people must have thought that, well, he's a sorcerer, and he,
right.
What's he all about? Some
right.
people thought that, you know, he's really a force that's for good, and he, you know, he has genuinely good intentions, and he is a savior. But there was a very large part of the population back then that probably kind of looked at him with a little bit of a jaundiced eye and said, well, what's this guy really doing?
Mm-hmm.
So I think that's really the case with great figures in history. Many times it's not all that clear, you know, are they really, do they really fall on one side of the fence or the other? Are they good? Are they evil? Are they the builder? Are they destroyer? Sometimes it's not so clear. In fact, more often than not, it isn't. And certainly the complexity of that situation is reflected in the character of Annalisa.
You know, it's interesting that you brought that back, because talking about Jesus and how you felt that, you know, his days, that he was perceived both ways, obviously, I think we can still say that that's being true. But it made me feel once again that the way the book unfolds, also with the patriarchy sort of falling aside, and obviously Annalisa becomes the first pope in your story, and yet we also can look around us and see that there are many people who are acknowledging what we might say is in some ways the end of a 2,000-year, rule of patriarchal, power, and the return of the divine feminine in many things, natural, of course, and then just in all sorts of, religious and spiritual, teachings. I think if we look now, so it feels to me like the book comes out at such a wonderful, poignant time because, as you say, it's fictionalized, but it's in the near future, and so based on things that are really currently at play in our world as we speak, and yet it seems like that we are touching upon the revelations of things that were true so many, years and years, obviously, 2,000 more years ago, that these truths are now just coming back into public awareness. Do you think that's true?
I think it's a great point. I think it's absolutely true. It gives rise to some very, very interesting discussions. First of all, the whole issue of the patriarchal dominance of the world we've had for a couple thousand years now, this is a cyclical thing. It wasn't always this way. It mm-hmm. won't always be this way. Mm-hmm. There was a time when the Magna Mater, they called the Earth Mother, or the goddess, was very much the basis for most of the world's religions. And for reasons that are a little too lengthy and complex to go into here, the scales of that tipped very dramatically to one side. And of course, during the time of the Roman Empire and Jesus' teaching in Palestine, most of the societies in the Western world, in particular, and other places, had gone over very much to a patriarchal form of dominance. And I think what we're seeing now very clearly is the breakdown of that. In fact, you might call Pope Annalise in the First Souls Trilogy the Traveler's Guide to the Brave New World, because mm-hmm. it really is breaking down. The old order is breaking down, and just the symbolism of a woman becoming the first pope in a 2,000-year-old unbroken line of male succession is the harbinger of the old world breaking down and the new one being born. Mm-hmm. Now, the question is, the new one is being born in a lot of war and violence and upheaval, and how will that all play out? Well, that's something that obviously you read in the book, but as a greater backdrop, I think we are seeing a rise of the feminine energy. And, this is not to sound overly metaphysical about this, but all throughout creation in the material world, the one energy manifests itself as a polarity, a kind of a yin-yang polarity, mm-hmm. well known to people. And the ancients, especially in the ancient mystical traditions, which were all but exterminated in the ancient Western mystical traditions, identified this as a male and female energy. Mm-hmm. And the male energy was characterized more by lineal, verbal, logical, or highly organizational type of thinking, left-brain thinking. And the female, on the other hand, was intuitive, creative, led from the heart more than led from the mind, and had more to do with feeling and rather than verbal expression. So these various qualities that we call male and female have always been part of the landscape. The thing is that they've been either more in vogue or less in vogue in different epochs of human history, and we've had a very heavy dose of the male side of that equation for a long time now. And what I really see now is the scales coming to balance. I see the rise of the feminine force, or the feminine principle, as we come into 2012, and it's evident all around us. Now, this doesn't mean we're not talking about things like equal pay or the feminist movement. Right. Those are political and social manifestations of something deeper. What we're really talking about is something that was very, very prevalent in the Lost Gospels that are discussed in the book, that were discovered in Egypt in 1945, mm-hmm. also called the Gnostic Gospels. Now, the Gnostics were one of the two main branches of early Christianity, and the Gnostics happened to be very spiritually advanced Christians. They were, I guess you would almost call them the graduate-level Christians, as opposed to the Orthodox Christianity, mm-hmm. whose concepts were much more fundamental. But unfortunately, the Gnostics lost out in history and were pretty much exterminated, so we lost a lot of their wisdom. But the Gnostics always had Jesus in the Bible saying something over and over again, which is the two must become one. And what it is called the sacred marriage. And what he really meant by the sacred marriage and the two becoming one is taking these male and female characteristics and coming to a balance within each of us, an operating symmetry of our left and right brains, of these qualities of these faculties of, you know, intuition versus logic and feeling versus thought and so forth, and balancing them within ourselves. And when we combine those qualities, which are qualities, frankly, I had to combine in the writing of this book, then we become whole human beings. Mm-hmm. And as whole human beings, we will experience more enlightened states. And as we go individually through this process, that's the way the world and the society goes, because the world and the society at large are, of course, a reflection of how we think and how we act and how we perceive as individuals.
Mm-hmm. You know, it's interesting because I think you're right dead on when you talk about the regaining the balance, obviously, and I think that we have been sort of out of balance for such a long time across the globe. But what's interesting to me and what I think is so profound is that, and again evidenced in your book, is that this sort of meeting of the minds, and you talked about metaphysics, and you know, and yet everywhere you look in every avenue or venue of revelation now with regard to looking at ancient traditions or looking at modern science, they all sort of seem to be exposing very, very common threads, and that reveals to me the essence of what really were the origins of what this whole spiritual beginnings of the world were about, right?
Well, certainly one of the things that I detected in my travels and my research and my meditations is that, yes, there is a common spiritual thread, a thread of spiritual wisdom that permeated every major religion on earth, mm-hmm. including the pagan ones and including the modern religions we have today, the three Abrahamic religions. And that was a spiritual wisdom, a spiritual knowledge or tradition. It wasn't a religion in itself. It was really more like the underpinning, the mystical underpinning of the major religions. Because in the West, if you take the three Abrahamic religions, Judaism, Christianity, and Islam, each of them started with a mystical core. There was the knowledge of the Kabbalah in Judaism. There was the Gnosticism in Christianity. And there is the Sufism or the Sufis in Islam. And they pretty much were all saying the same thing. In fact, these three aspects of those religions had more in common with one another than they had with their outer religions. Because, unfortunately, prophets speak the heart of God, their followers start religions. Mm-hmm. And the mystic impulse, the revelations that were experienced by the prophets are, of course, were not the direct experience of their followers. So their followers now had to come up with interpretations of what the prophet meant, what the prophet was saying, and so forth. And, you know, and of course, that now starts to get involved in politics and ego and personal agendas. So mm-hmm. very early on, you usually have the manipulation of the mystic core of a religion, and then it evolves into its institutional forms, usually with hierarchies and, you know, some people in positions of power kind of dictating dogmas to the, you know, to the rest of the masses below there.
Right.
And unfortunately, that's what happens. But this universal spiritual tradition, it doesn't really lend itself to one quick and easy overriding definition, but we can talk about some of its attributes. A very abbreviated description of this wisdom would tell us that human beings are actually physical entities containing projections of God's own spiritual essence. And that means that humans are really emanations or expressions of the infinite in finite form that are here in a material world for the purpose of evolving God's plan or God's consciousness into matter. We're sort of the fingers. You can think of human beings in a way as the fingers of God that allow God to touch this material world, which is very different from the world of spirit, and experience it, mm-hmm. and experience it in the form of you and me and the listeners and so forth. Mm-hmm. Now, this is opposed to the common views that we've been raised in the Judeo-Christian tradition that tell us we're humans. We're sort of, well, like lumps of clay, and, you know, one day God breathed life force into them and kind of wound us up like these little dolls to bounce around an earthly insane asylum. But it's something very different to say that a human being is really a projection of God's essence, working out God's plan, mm-hmm. as opposed to saying that a human being is, you know, was sort of this separate creation that was created separate and apart from the deity and is now basically living out a life which consists of atoning for the sin of being born, which is, you know, essentially Christian theology, which is original sin. We're all tainted as we come into this world by the sin of Adam and Eve, which, you know, actually sets up for a pretty bleak line of theology. So there is a radical difference in what the ancient tradition taught and what our modern religions tell us today. And this was the belief of the Egyptian mystery schools, of the Oracle at Delphi, the Eleusinian mysteries of the Greek and Roman world, and the early proponents of Christianity, Judaism, and Islam, these were common beliefs that they held before those beliefs were, you know, anathematized and basically, you know, said to be the belief of heretics and kind of destroyed and oppressed. But this personal experience, this ability for each person to personally experience the divine, was called gnosis. Now, gnosis is the Greek word to know, mm-hmm. and it doesn't mean know in the sense in the common sense of just to be aware of something. It means knowledge gained through experience.
Right.
There is a very big difference between faith and knowledge. Now, faith, obviously, in our traditional religion, plays a very big role. We're taught to take a lot of things on faith, that the church or the synagogue or the imam, you know, might tell us, and we're taught to take all these things on faith. And, you know, certainly that means that it's not something that you've experienced, but it's something somebody else is telling you, which they're asking you to believe. The difference between gnosis and faith is that gnosis is actually a direct experience that one has touching the divine energy. And it manifests in different ways. In my life, it manifested in different phenomena, and it's different for different people. But what it really does have in common is that you touch a higher intelligence that gives you information that you could possibly not know otherwise, and it leaves you with a feeling that you are absolutely connected to something much larger than yourself, that you're connected to the rest of humanity, that you're connected to the rest of this natural world by an unseen force, because how would you possibly gain knowledge of the things that you had gained during this experience without that common thread, that invisible thread running underneath, connecting you to everything? So it really gives you a sense that of unity and how closely we are connected at an unseen level. And that experience, that Gnostic or enlightened experience, is not something that's just reserved for special people.
Mm-mm.
Anybody can have that experience. Now, some will have an easier time of it than others by virtue of a lot of different circumstances. In my own life, I know I devoted from the time I was pretty young. I was always spiritually oriented, and I devoted a great amount of my life to learning and studying. First, it started off as book reading, it started off as a feeling of alienation. Then it went from alienation to investigation, which was book reading and talking to people. And then it went from there to meditation and you know, direct experience with these spiritual practices. So everybody can walk that path if they have the desire. It's not easy to do. It's time-consuming. You have to take personal responsibility for your own spiritual growth, and responsibility is a real buzzword in society nowadays, but the thing that we're least responsible for is our spiritual growth. We tend to give that over to institutions and governments and science, and that's where our spirituality and our faith seem to deposit these days. But it's something that is possible for anybody, and the rewards, and the insights and the rewards and the ability to guide your life in a different direction are great rewards from it.
I think one of the things I've witnessed, and I think you speak to this as well, and you mentioned it in your writings, when you talk about people, and I would totally agree with you with regard to sort of the pop culture around New Age spirituality or buzzwords and things such as that, but that aside, the authenticity, the level of awakening that seems to be apparently occurring globally, where people are really stepping into the same realm of possibility with reconnecting to these higher levels of consciousness, as you call it. And I think enough of that is going on around the world with enough people holding that space that we are seeing a shift in what is going on, because it then changes the sort of what you write about and what people well know about it, the collective consciousness or unconsciousness. So in some ways it feels to me that even the guy on the couch holding the remote who has no interest or clue about anything religious or spiritual might in fact be profiting as we speak from those people who are doing all the work and a lot of the work with regard to, you know, moving into these states of awakening.
Yes, this is completely true. Some of this is touched upon in the book, but, you know, I think a lot of people are aware of the 100 monkey story and how they had the monkeys on a particular island who, you know, were taught to wash potatoes. And first it was one monkey, then without human intervention, other monkeys in the island started to learn. But then the amazing thing was, at a certain point, monkeys on the first island had learned, then monkeys on neighboring islands started picking up the skill right afterwards, and there was no contact between them.
Mm-hmm.
So it really, if you really think about it for a second, we're all connected. We may not be aware of that. We may be sleeping on mm-hmm. that fact, but we're all connected.
Mm-hmm.
And if you think of human brain as a collection of brain cells, and they communicate through the synapses, through electrical impulses in the synapses, that's an energy field. The whole human body, the whole human brain operates as an energy net, in effect.
Mm-hmm.
Well, the whole human existence is just a macrocosm of that event. We're all like cells in a giant mind, in a giant brain. And as the cells awaken and they begin to transmit their knowledge to the adjacent cells, those cells then receive the electrical charge and they start to awaken. Now, those cells were asleep. It's not like they got up and they started exercising to get that energy. The energy was imparted by you know, various means, osmotic or whatever. And I think that that's what you're touching upon. So that the answer is yes. I do think that when we reach a critical mass of awareness and enough people have these realizations and experiences, it tends to catch on like wildfire. It's like the tinder that ignites the flame, and that flame spreads beyond the original boundaries.
Mm-hmm. It actually also gets back to the goal you had of talking about the origin, destiny, and purpose of humanity, which, you know, was really your basis for starting off with the trilogy anyway, because Pope Annalisa is the first book in what will be three, and
right.
the First Souls trilogy. And you talk about that, and what we're really looking at is, again, us, you know, reaching a point in human evolution where we begin to accept the rememberings of our origins, which is obviously spirit, not falling into a lower vibration and being affected by gravity and the density of materialism.
The trilogy is the chronicle of the grand unfoldment of the human purpose and destiny in terms of remembrance of our spiritual origins,
mm-hmm.
that we evolved from the infinite to the finite, and now we are evolving again from the finite back to the infinite,
mm-hmm.
and yet we bring all that new knowledge of separate existence, of what it's like to be an individual in a material world. We bring that knowledge into spirit. So I think the book really, rather than, you know, Judeo-Christianity really kind of puts the human being in a rather denigrated position. We're basically sinners here, and if we do X, Y, and Z and we act good, we might regain God's grace. The view of the book is much different than that. The view of the book is that essentially we are the emissaries of the divine energy. We are parts of that divine being and that divine energy.
Right.
Evolved or devolved, let's say, from the infinite to the finite. And the finite takes the experience of the materiality, the thought of separation with free will as individuals, as opposed to the unified divine energy. It's a new experience for the divine energy to step itself down and limit itself, in effect, so that it experiences individuality through limitation. And yet the irony is that eventually the limitation starts to awaken and remember and evolves itself back to a unity, but bringing the experience of what it was like to exist in that individualized, solid, limited form.
Right, right. I mean, it is that, you know, that interesting since the dawn of man, right? The good versus evil, because, I mean, really, when you talk about it, of the denseness of the materiality, which also includes, you know, the ego, you know, power, control, materialism, all of those things, hunger for power and control, you know, that really is the holding on to that everything. And we know that. I mean, I can look around in my own life, I mean, and say what you're writing about and what you're representing through the fictional story is absolutely playing out in my life personally and everybody's life, is that we have that struggle of hanging on to, you know, the things that are not reality at all, but we hold on and don't want them to not be reality, if that makes any sense, right?
Well, yeah, I mean, it all relates to one thing, and that is that the line between good and evil is not a fast and set line. I think evil was almost a necessity,
mm-hmm.
To go through the experience that we have in mm-hmm. this world, because the way the ancients would have explained it and the way the Gnostics would have explained it, which I think is a, you know, that God emanated a whole series of spiritual beings on down from the original source, and that eventually these spiritual beings kind of, you know, crossed over the barrier into material creation, but their essence, their energy remained the same. It's almost like, think of a ray of light passing through different mediums. It will take on different appearances,
right,
in different mediums, but it's all part of that one ray of light coming from the source. And yet the Gnostics said that as God, or as the deity, let's call it, or the energy, whatever people feel comfortable with, as this intelligence spread out from its original source, it was kind of like, think of a CD or a DVD. Every time we make copies of a CD or a DVD, each copy is successively got a little less clarity and a little less resolution than the original. And so as spirit projected farther from its core, its clarity about its source became more obscured. It became less and less. There was more forgetfulness, in effect, at each stage of spiritual evolution, until finally we come to the lowest form of spiritual evolution, the lowest form of energy vibration, which is here on Earth. So the shadow or ignorance of the source, which is where evil arises from, was pretty much almost always present right from the beginning, even probably in the non-material dimensions.
Mm-hmm.
And this shadow was simply a degree. It's simply a forgetting of our source. And the deeper we fall into shadow, and the more we go away from our source, the more we think we are individuals acting with free will,
mm-hmm,
and we will misuse this free will, because the deeper in shadow we are, the more evil actions that we can commit, we commit, because we've simply lost our sense of unity and where we come from.
Mm-hmm.
So that this entire world is a mixture of light and shadow, and even I believe in the spiritual dimension, there's still ignorance. There's a mixture of light and shadow as we get further and further away from the source. But as we become more enlightened, meaning that we refocus back on the light of our source and we start moving back in that direction, we start to recapture more of that awareness, and we start to awaken, we start to remember. So life in and of itself is not so much really a question of learning. It's more a question of remembering. It's a question of remembering where we came from, remembering our source, and the closer we get to our source, the more the light dispels the shadow. But that shadow was probably almost a necessary part of living in the way the grand scheme was was designed.
I think it is. I think it's just like the whole hot, cold, up, down. I mean, we need the opposite of what we have, you know, to be able to really push against, to see, you know, to have it make any sense at all. So it certainly seems that you're right on that. You know, it's interesting because obviously anyone reading the book will say, wow, that's just too close to home. I mean, so many of the plots, the subplots seem so real and so, you know, like if you've been reading, studying the newspaper for the past, you know, several years, because it seems like it's just so relative to what's going on in our world right now. And without giving away the book, because I really want to encourage people to, our listeners to go, you know, get it and read it. It's the first of the three, as we said. Do you have a sense of having written the book and having connected to these channels of information that you achieve or touch through your meditations, do you have a sense of confidence, I guess that might be the word to use, with regard to the potential outcomes for where we're headed as a human race right now?
Well, I the funny thing about the book is I had to rewrite it during the course of its history, which is about a 10-year history. I had to rewrite it several times because it predicted the first Gulf War in Iraq, and then it predicted the second Gulf War in Iraq, so I rewrote it then. And then I said, okay, well, you know, I think we're going to switch the plot line over to Iran secretly acquiring nuclear weapons and then getting into a confrontation with the United States. And this was long before the news came out about Iran and Iran's nuclear ambitions and the boycotts that they're now trying to put together and solve the current problem.
Right.
But at that point, I said, "No way, I'm not rewriting this again. I could be doing this. I could be doing this ad infinitum." So I decided to cut it off right there.
Yeah.
But I think a lot of the direction that was born out of my desire to write a classic universal story, but that was embodied in current themes that people could recognize and relate to their own lives. So the events may be timely, but I think the the real meat of the story, the solutions to the story are very classic and universal, and would apply to, you know, could apply to any period, any culture,
right.
any situation, any, you know, in at any point in history.
Right.
I am optimistic. I mean, sometimes we look around and, you know, we can get terribly pessimistic, but the world has really always been in some form of dire straits or another. Of course, now it gets a little bit more pointed in the weapons of mass destruction that are available out there, and the obvious willingness of some people who are very deeply steeped in the shadow to use those weapons. So
right.
It takes on something much more pointed. But I do believe, and this is why I wanted to really write a book about spirit transcending religions. Once we remove the superficiality of these religious disagreements, and if we could really understand the common spiritual wisdom that was part of our tradition, and really everyone can claim it. Everyone can go back and claim a piece of the spiritual wisdom that we've been discussing if they are willing to brush aside and get out of the box some of the things that their institutional religions have been drilling into their heads. And, you know, again, it's not this book is not meant to bash religion, because it takes religion, like, let's say, Catholicism, for instance.
Right.
It's not a church-bashing book like so many books out there are.
Right.
It's a book that says, you know what, the precepts of Christianity were, let's say, spirituality 101, but now we've got to take those for what they are and use, you know, the ideas and the concepts from that to move on and become more spiritually mature and not get locked into the box. So whereas most religions want to stop you in your tracks and say, okay, wait a minute, stop here. We've got the answers, and here's the package we're going to give you. Here's the terminology. Here's the dogmas and beliefs, and you become a member of, with us, you know, if you subscribe to these. That's where spirituality kind of gets boxed in. If you view your spiritual growth as just that, it's a progress, it's a road along the way, and Christianity or Judaism or Islam may be one of the way stations along the road, and you say, fine, okay, I'm going to take what I can from this stop, and I'm going to use it for the rest of my journey. That's I think, a healthy attitude, and that's what this book tries to present. So the hope in this book is that if people start to look at things in this way and we overcome the superficialities and divisions of religions and governments and institutions and the way those think, that people can actually rise up with much greater awareness and much greater individual empowerment to say, you know what, we're not going to put up with this baloney anymore, okay? Mm-hmm. We're not going to allow people to go around and murder on a mass basis over a cynical ideology that has these poor kids strapping on bombs while the perpetrators, you know, sit around, breaking all the laws that they purport to believe in. I mean, there's something fundamentally wrong about, a world that allows that to happen, and I think that once we dispel the divisions between us that allow those people to exist through the cracks, that there's less and less room for those type of people so inclined to maneuver. The answer to your question, I am optimistic. I do feel that it's not that we're not going to go through some hairy times, and there's all of a sudden all the evil in the world is going to disappear overnight. Mm. But like you said, we get back to that shift that's occurring.
Mm-hmm.
And if it's really true, and I believe it is, that the feminine energy is rising, that those qualities are much more intuitive. They're about mercy, they're about love, they're about feeling, but in a practical way. This is something that's coming into balance with the male qualities, not to supplant the male qualities.
Right, right.
So that we go from one extreme to the other, not to go from, you know, a world that's, let's say, overly harsh and regimented to one that's just so nice and kind of airy fairy that, you know, it just can't get anything accomplished in the real world, but to come to a balance. And that with that feminine principle coming back into focus, I think the world has a much better chance for survival, because this will put us closer to an appreciation of nature. It will put us closer to our intuitive feeling, which tells us there's something intrinsically wrong about killing other people.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that we have a much better survival chance as we see that feminine principle rising.
Right. Actually, I think it's happening as we speak. Obviously, your book is a fictionalized story, but certainly has lots of plots that talk about this very thing. But I think if you pay attention and look all around you, that the shadow is being illuminated by people who are being exposed, and transparency, which is coming. I know that's also another word that seems to be overused these days. But, I mean, even with regard to the Catholic Church, it's quite interesting because I follow the news very closely. And even the Catholic Church, it's just dumbfounding to me over the past year some of the things that they've been required to step up to the plate on just because of people saying that's enough. And, you know, I mean, even an article I read a couple weeks ago that said that they're actually taking a look at investigating the possibility of aliens. Now, when in our lifetime had you ever thought that the Catholic Church would start talking about aliens? But, you know, I think it's true. I think people have reached, I think that it talked about this in the book too. You mentioned it as a book in the book, but just as people have reached a point where they are fed up with and ready to step into the way of living and being as a human being, because of enough people waking up in this world and saying that just is, I'm not going to tolerate that anymore. And
yeah, and the Catholic Church is a really interesting institution. I mean, this is not a Catholic book, by the way, for those people out there that aren't, you know, of the Catholic faith.
Mm-hmm.
The Catholic Church is really a vehicle that, you know, that is a great vehicle to tell a universal story.
Right.
Essentially, the Catholic Church is an institution that is predicated on preserving things frozen in a certain period of time, and it has great difficulty navigating through the modern world because of that fact. So we're not very far from an African pope. We're, of course, further away from a female pope. But even the Catholic Church cannot withstand the forces of evolution. There will come a day when things change in the Catholic Church in and of itself. I fully believe there will be such a thing as female priests and bishops and eventually a pope. Well, will it happen in our lifetime? I can't really say that for sure, but it will come. It will happen. It has to, because the Catholic Church, as much as it may try and isolate itself, it is a part of the world. The Church is the body of the people, and as the attitudes of the people change, the Church must change. Now, right now, you kind of see a dissonance, you kind of see a separation a lot of times between the actions of the Vatican and most parishioners or most Catholics. That's been that way for a while, especially in America. A lot of Americans don't really pay attention to everything that Rome says. And there's sort of like, you know, there's sort of like a wink and a nod, and the Church gets its way through. But the Church really is, ultimately, it's not about the bishops and the hierarchy and the dogmas. It's about the people. And eventually, as the consciousness of the people change, the consciousness of the Church has to change.
Right.
It may take a while, but it certainly will happen. Everything will change. This force that's sweeping the globe is a transformative force, and it will change everything. And my prediction is that in the Western world, Mary Magdalene will become a symbol as an archetype for this force coming into being. And it's kind of interesting that when I started this project out about 10 years ago, Magdalene was still a biblical figure of relative obscurity. Well, not relative obscurity, almost absolute obscurity.
Right.
There was something in the Bible that hints at the fact that, you know what, she was really important. She was always with Jesus. She was the first one to see the risen Christ. I mean, there was something very, very important about this lady, and you get little snippets of it, but she was hardly in there. Nobody really ever spoke of her. We didn't know really very much about her until in 1945 they discovered this whole alternate set of gospels, the Gnostic Gospels.
Right.
And in those gospels, Mary Magdalene was actually the main disciple, along with probably at least seven other women. But she was the main disciple of all the disciples. She was the one who understood Jesus' secret wisdom teachings more than the others did. And in fact, it was her role, because of the questions that she always used to ask Jesus, she would help him formulate the responses in order to help enlighten the other disciples. So she was viewed by the Gnostics as a co-equal. In fact, some held her to be the female counterpart of the Christ, which was the Holy Spirit incarnated.
Right.
Some went so far as that. Others said that she was certainly the companion and the primary disciple who was the one who really understood the inner teachings, whereas St. Peter, just on the opposite side, was kind of pictured as a little bit of a simpleton, and he didn't really get it.
Right.
And he was very slow in his understandings, and he was also very jealous of Mary Magdalene because of the fact that she clearly was a real light or a luminary in the circles of the disciples. So we get a very, very different picture of Mary Magdalene, her importance in the Gnostic Gospels, and it really leads one to believe that the whole pattern of Mary sort of being looming there in the regular Bible, but never really kind of fully being described, almost smacks of a concerted effort to edit women and edit Mary Magdalene out of the Bible, which is my personal belief of what happened.
Right.
Which is that when Christy in the patriarchal world they were in,
right,
Jesus' teachings about women were so incredibly radical.
Right.
And the fact that he viewed them as equals, and I mean, you cannot understand in the modern world how radical that was, because women's role was so suppressed back in those days. They were really looked down upon, despised even, and, you know, just good for certain things. That for Jesus to take the attitude towards women that he did was almost grounds to, you know, for death back then in the Jewish society.
Right.
So when Christianity was vying to become the state religion of the Roman Empire against all the other various religious cults that, you know, were flourishing throughout the empire at that time, having so many female leaders in the church became an embarrassment. And they sort of gradually started weeding out the females from the church hierarchy and from the Gospels, in effect. They wrote them out of the Gospels,
right,
in order to become more acceptable to Rome. And eventually they did, because Constantine made Christianity the state religion. I was somewhere around 321 to 325, I think. Christianity became the state religion of the Roman Empire. So Mary Magdalene and the other female disciples sort of vanished in history. But now, as part of this rising femininity that we're talking about, I think that she's going to become your symbol in the Western world for the resurgence of this whole feminine wave.
You know, it's interesting, too, because it was quite a number of decades after Jesus' crucifixion that they even started writing. Most of the people were illiterate, and, you know, so the teachings of Jesus had really been passed down, you know, hand-to-mouth sort of thing, you know, from a long time, or, you know, stories told. I mean, that was the way that you know, records were kept, is by storytelling, wasn't it? So, I mean, we talk about the authentic teachings of Jesus. That's even really, you know, been questioned and looked at carefully, in our day now, you know.
Yeah, that's a fascinating story in and of itself.
Mm-hmm.
In the Bible, in the regular synoptic Gospels, Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John, it's said several times in the Bible that Jesus spoke to the masses in parables, but to the disciples he spoke of the real mysteries. And then you have the writings of the early church fathers, like Clement of Alexandria, who said that when St. Mark, who was the secretary to St. Peter, came to Alexandria after Peter's crucifixion, he brought with him the secret teachings of the Lord that were not to be spoken to the public, but to be given to the elect, meaning those who were spiritually mature enough to receive them.
Mm-hmm.
So then the Gnostics are much more explicit about that whole idea of the secret teaching. So this oral tradition, which was partly oral, partly written, let's say,
mm-hmm,
of the secret teaching, or the advanced, let's call them the esoteric or advanced spiritual teachings that Jesus taught, were not handed out on a mass basis, but were dealt with in much smaller circles where they could be more explained and understood and accepted by people who were more inclined to do so. And that seems to be a very strong circumstantial case from all sides that secret teaching existed. And this is the teaching that was passed on to Mary Magdalene. So a lot of people ask, you know, well, is your book like the Da Vinci Code relative to Mary Magdalene?
Right.
Well, in the Da Vinci Code, Mary Magdalene was treated as the Holy Grail, or the repository of Jesus' children, because they go by, that book was all about the old bloodline theory of Magdalene and Jesus having, you know, progeny.
Right.
In the First Soul trilogy and Pope Annalisa, that question has no importance. I mean, whether Jesus and Magdalene were married or whether they had children, other than historical curiosity, it has no practical importance for humanity. But where Mary is treated as the Holy Grail in Pope Annalisa is the repository of Jesus' secret teaching.
Right.
So there's a very big difference there. First of all, that's a much more elevated role than just to be a child bearer.
Right,
You're the bearer of the universe.
Absolutely, yeah. That's a step up, isn't it?
Yeah.
to say the least.
You're the bearer of a universal wisdom to be transmitted to, you know, humankind. Unfortunately, with the triumph of the Orthodox Church and the institutional church, the Gnostic core, this mystical core of Christianity, was destroyed in the first two centuries after Christ, much to the detriment of the Western world and our spiritual views, and really almost everything that's happened and the way the whole Western world evolved was very much tied up in the loss of this beautiful tradition and this knowledge.
Well, I think truth has a way of finding its way to the top, and I think we'll see it reemerge. I think you can push it away, but I think it's going to right itself, and I think that's what we're in the throes of witnessing in our lifetime. Hopefully we'll see more and more lead us in that direction.
And it did. You know, what you're saying is absolutely true, because as the Gnostics were destroyed, Gnosticism cropped up in so many different ways throughout the ages.
Yeah.
In the tarot.
Yeah, yeah.
Rosicrucians.
Yeah. Everywhere. You just can't hide it. You know?
Yeah, it's been there. Alchemy, the mm-hmm. alchemists were clearly very Gnostic in their orientation. I mean, it was there. It was, in a sense, and this is talked about in the church, it was an underground church.
Mm-hmm.
It was the secret underground church of this holy wisdom mm-hmm. trying to reemerge against the oppression of the outer church, of the public institutional church.
Mm-hmm.
And it's always been there. And now, and the new age basically was you know, very much an outcropping. This, I think, sometimes a little bit of a misguided outcropping, but nonetheless, it was an expression mm-hmm. of this sacred wisdom and knowledge, which was nearly lost to us. And the finding of those Gnostic Gospels in 1945, which is the year the war ended and right after the first atomic bomb was dropped in Hiroshima and Nagasaki,
right.
to me is no coincidence.
Right.
I think at one of the darkest periods of human history,
right.
the discovery of this ancient wisdom in that desert in Egypt in that year, I just cannot believe that was coincidence.
Yeah.
In the Mahabharata, the great Indian spiritual epic,
right.
it describes something that even people in the West have believed, some people in the West have believed for a long time, which is that God or the spirit sends redeemers or bringers of the light at different epochs of history when things get darkest in order to set the path straight so that we don't completely lose our way in materiality.
Right.
And we try and, you know, keep on that path to enlightenment. And in the Mahabharata, Krishna, who is God, says to Arjuna that when evil is strong and good is on the decline, I incarnate from age to age to set virtue back on its throne. So what Krishna is expressing in the Bhagavad Gita is this whole idea of that God will send these waves of redeemers, of which Jesus was certainly one, and
Absolutely.
The other prophets were,
right.
And they will enlighten, they will help enlighten humans at different stages of history with different forms of revelation. Now, you know, the Mosaic Law was a revelation in its time. There was another revelation that was maybe, say something a little bit more advanced, let's say, which was the new covenant that Jesus spoke about, which introduced the God of love from the old, you know, in distinction from the Old Testament God. So these are all different cultural expressions, but redeemers appear in all races, cultures, and geographical areas of the world with the aim of re-enlightening, humanity when we tend to fall back into darkness.
Right. I would agree with you completely. Can you believe we're here at the end of our time? It's already flown by.
That went quickly.
It did go quickly. That just shows you we have to talk again sometime soon because there's so much to talk about and it's so interesting. Tell me a couple of things. When can we expect, and I know book number one is just coming out in hardback in early June, right?
Yeah, the publication date is June 1st, but I believe it can be ordered at most stores now. It should be on most of the distributors' databases so that if you go into a Barnes & Noble, or you go into Borders, let's say, they can probably order it for you. It should be in the shelves by sometime this summer, hopefully. And a lot of that, of course, depends on how many people listen to shows like yours and go out and buy the book. That'll really help it get on the shelves, because that's what
makes people
stand up and listen.
Yeah.
You should be able to order. I know it's on back order right now on Amazon.com. I checked that out the other day.
Great.
And the hardcover version is available for back order on Amazon. So most of your major outlets, if you go in and ask for Pope Annalisa, the hardcover version, they should be able to make it available. And you can also, for those of your listeners who are curious, you can also go to my website, PopeAnnalisa.com. That's one word, PopeAnnalisa.com.
Right.
And the website is great because it has some videos, video trailers about the book, and it's got a lot of information, like what we were talking about today, the thematic background and some of the material that went into the making of the book.
Right. It's very fascinating. Peter, thank you so much for joining me. I'd love to have you back so we can talk more, because there's just, as I said, so many important pieces of this history and, where we're headed to bring to our listeners. It's very hopeful, and I love the fact that you wrote the book. I'll be looking forward. Peter, thank you so much. What a pleasure talking to you. I really thank you for what you're bringing us, and I will look forward to all the work that you offer us in the future.
Well, it was a lot of fun, and thanks for having me.
My pleasure. Bye-bye for now. Bye.